Blog Talk Radio.
This is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host for this show and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call and listen by dialing on your phone, 516-531-9540. And if you want to ask a question after you are connected, press 1, and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We're also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Productions sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Today on Port of Harlem Talk Radio, we will talk with 3 people: writer Peter Bailey, photographer David Ogborn, and oral historian Janet Sims Wood. Each one have impacted Port of Harlem Magazine. We talk about 3 people they have gotten to know and how those 3 people impacted them: Malcolm X, Chancellor James Williams, and Dovey Johnson Rowntree, respectively. Feel free to read the related story, Each One, Taught One, Life Impactors, at portofharlem.net. Our first guest is A. Peter Bailey, or more completely known as Alfonso Peter Bailey. Hello, Peter. How are you doing today?
Hey, nice to be talking to you, Wayne. Forget about that darn Alfonso. I use that only in the most official type things.
I use
A. Peter Bailey.
I just had to sort of put that in there because, you know, I always see the
A. I know. That's why you did it.
I was thinking, where's the other one at? So, Peter, in 1962, you moved to Harlem, New York City. And in 1964, you became a founding member of Malcolm X's Organization of African American Unity, or OAAU. And you were the editor of the OAAU newsletter, Blacklash. So first, how did meeting and working with Malcolm X affect your life?
It totally changed my life. What happened is that I moved to Harlem in the summer, in June of 1962, and got in on a Friday night and decided Saturday morning, rather than unpacking bags, my roommate and I decided that we were going to walk Lenox Avenue, which is now Malcolm X Boulevard. So we walked down from 142nd Street. We were going to go to 125th Street, which, of course, is right in the center of Harlem. But then we got 125th. We tried to walk further, and we got down to 116th and saw a crowd gathering. And we asked the crowd, "What's going on?" And they said, "Malcolm X is going to speak." Now, at that time, I had heard about him. I had not heard him speak. I heard very little about him, but what I had heard was very negative. You know, he hates white folks, and he does this, and he believes in violence and that kind of stuff. So my roommate, I said, "Let's hear what he got to say." And Brother Malcolm spoke for 3 hours, and by the time he finished those three hours, I was a Malcolmite. He spoke for almost 3 hours, Wayne, and it was a June afternoon outside in the sun.
Uh-huh.
And by the time he got through, I was a Malcolmite. I had never heard anyone talk about race in this country with such clarity, knowledge, passion, and seriousness. I mean, he laid it out. And one thing particularly I remember him telling me that I had never heard anyone in my life talk about. And he spent at least 45 minutes of his presentation talking about psychological warfare, the attacks on the mind. And I had never heard anyone talk. I was 20 years old. I had never heard anyone talk before about attacks on the mind. And then I began to think about going up to Tuskegee, Alabama, and going to those segregated movie theaters in Tuskegee. They didn't have separate and black, and they didn't have white folks, black folks sitting in the balcony. They had 2 completely separate movie theaters side by side. So I went to the black one between about 6 years old and about 13. Every Saturday we were down there watching movies. And a lot of times we saw Tarzan movies. And we laughed at the Africans and talked about them. And if you wanted to get into a fight, you call somebody black or you call them African. That was the way it was in Tuskegee. And I remember all those other things growing up, those kind of attacks on the mind type thing. So to hear somebody talk about that that I had never heard before in my life, I said I was 20. I was 21 at that time. And I became a Malcolm X supporter. And so wherever I was not going to become a member of the Nation of Islam. I had kind of gone to the age when I was just dropping Christianity, and I had no desire to join another religion. But everywhere he spoke in the New York City metropolitan area, I was there. I don't care where it was. I was there to listen to it. And this kept up until 1963, in the winter of 1963. I was working at Time, Inc. as an editorial reference clerk. And a friend of mine I had met her. She was working in NBC as an intern. They were just beginning to take on black interns. She was one of the interns. And they had, under the ground that we could sit and eat. So we would eat and talk about things that were going on, politically and all that kind of stuff. And one day she said to me, would you like to be a member of a new organization? And I said, what organization? And she said, well, I'm not going to tell you any details. I'll call you Saturday morning and tell you when to meet and where to meet, and don't ask no questions. So she called me Saturday morning, and I went to the spot where she told us to meet. And when I walked in there, I saw people like John Henry Clark, who I did not know, but I knew who he was, and a couple of other people who I recognized. And we all sat around talking. And after I'd been there maybe about 15, 20 minutes, in walks Brother Mal. It wasn't until he walked through that door that I knew that I was going to be part of something with him. And he came in and sat down and introduced himself, and then everybody introduced themselves. And that began the formation of the organization that became known as the Organization of Afro-American Unity, OAAU. And, of course, it was named after the Organization of African Unity, which had been founded in 1963. This is January 1964. It had been founded in July, I think it was, in 1963. And this was and they had their first conference in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and they were having their second one in Cairo, Egypt. But that's where he got the name. He basically told us that the name was going to be the Organization of Afro-American Unity. So that's how I met Brother Malcolm.
How did these meetings and these discussions and these talks impact your life?
Okay. I'll tell you what it does. It is the reason that I am a journalist today is because of it. Because after we had met had several meetings, and people began to talk about, being on various committees, the youth committee, the economics committee, political committee, education committee, health committee, no one had said anything about being in charge of a newsletter. Brother Malcolm made it very clear that he believed that we had to have our own instrument for getting our information out. You cannot depend on any of the press, in New York City to do that. So I volunteered to do the newsletter, though I had no experience in journalism. I had had no, my thing that I had always wanted to be a teacher of history. That had been what I thought about being at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up becoming the editor of the newsletter, and that's why I became a journalist. The profound impact he had on my life, because he made me understand the importance of communications and the importance of having an instrument to get your own message out, depending on other people to get your message out.
Wow. So you were at the first meeting or at the organizing meeting for the OAAU and the first editor of their newsletter.
First editor of the news and only one,
The only one.
Kind of ceased publishing after the assassination.
Gotcha. So you remained in that position the whole time.
Yeah. And the first three issues were called the OAAU newsletter. Then there began to be a lot of talk in New York City about the white backlash. So the brother who was in charge of production, now we decided, what we're going to do? We're going to call our newsletter the Blacklash. So beginning with the fourth issue and from the fourth through ninth issue, it became the Blacklash, and that's what we call it, the OAAU Blacklash.
Are any of those preserved somewhere?
Copies of all nine of the all nine of them that we put out. The originals are in the Schomburg Center.
Gotcha.
in New York, the Potomac Center of Research in Black Culture in New York. That's where the originals are. But I have copies of all 9 issues.
And you've already written one book on Malcolm X's life. I think you're writing your second one. Is that correct?
Yes. I wrote basically what I wrote initially in 2013. I wrote a memoir about mm-hmm. that experience of working with Brother Malcolm. I tell my students, you know, I've taught since 1998 to 2017. I taught at 3 different colleges and universities. And I mainly journalism students. And I would always tell them that the importance, you know, of communications and the importance of knowing how to use the right words, you know, and that kind of thing, you know. And so that's how I really seriously got into teaching journalism, because, you know, I had never thought I would be a journalism professor. First of all, I had dropped out of Howard after 2 years. I didn't have what's the first degree? A BA.
A BS degree.
No bachelor's or PhD or nothing like that. So I had to really, and I must very quickly here give credit to Howard, because it was at Howard in my sophomore year at Howard University that I had a professor named Dr. Harold Lewis. And this brother was an incredible historian, man. It was him who introduced me to black history.
Okay.
21 years old now, being introduced to black history for the first time. And any kind of, you know, I'm talking about, you know, organized way of learning it. You know, you hear things here and there. But this brother,
But that's even after going to school in Tuskegee, Alabama?
Yeah, well, in Tuskegee, mm-hmm. I learned, taught by Irish Catholic nuns and an Irish Catholic priest. I went to that school solely because it was closest to where I live. Rather than go walk way up on the campus to go to school, that school was maybe about a 10 or 12 minute walk from where I lived. So my parents, you know, switched me there. And I learned more Irish by the time I graduated in eighth grade. I didn't know nothing about black history, but I knew Irish history backwards and forwards. biggest day of the year for us other than Christmas and New Year's was we celebrated St. Patrick's Day. Then I went to the high school. And in Tuskegee, you heard about Booker T. Washington, and you heard about George Washington Carver, and that was it. They didn't teach us black history in any kind of organized way.
Okay, to get us back on track. So I just want to get that out the way, because I want to get back on track that this guy taught you more about black history at Howard. And that's why it was so important, because you hadn't gotten it when you were in Tuskegee, Alabama.
That's right. And I believe to this day that he was one of the main reasons that I was open when I heard Brother Malcolm.
Gotcha.
I give him credit for that.
But
that class back under him, man, where he taught us African American history, he taught us African history, he taught some Chinese history, some Japanese history, and Native American history.
But refresh my memory on your
he
book.
Made
on
read,
Malcolm.
Man.
I
he made us read, but we. You had to read to get out of that class.
Yeah, but refresh my memory on your books on Malcolm. I thought you had written at least one on him and maybe one with his sister. Is that correct?
Oh, here's what I did. I did the writing. Although I'm put down as a co-writer. But
okay.
His sister, Ella Collins, and her son, Rodney Collins, approached me in, I think it was 1991. About writing a book on Brother Malcolm. Like, basically, it's really what it is. It's Sister Ella's memoir. You know, that's the sister that he went to live with in Boston when he was, I think, 13 or 14 years old. It's basically her memoir. And they knew that I had met Rodnell, you know, back during the days, even in the OAAU, I had met her and met him. So when they got ready to do that, they asked me to write it. And so it's called Seventh Child, A Family Memoir of Malcolm X. And it has a tremendous amount of history on the little family, Brother Malcolm's family. We went down to Georgia, the places in Georgia where Brother Malcolm's family had been enslaved. We went down there. You know, I mean, it was quite an experience. In fact, I got something right now just 2 weeks ago. I'm on the board of directors of the Malcolm X Betty Shabbat, Malcolm X, of the College Center in Boston. They have now been added to the National Historic Registry. the Malcolm X Ella Collins Cultural Education and Culture Center in Boston, and then there's going to be a Malcolm X Park in Boston.
Okay.
And I just got worried about 3 weeks ago that they have an activity up in late May. They want me to come up to Boston to be, you know, to be a part of that official designation.
Wow.
Those two events.
And the reason I was asking about your past book, because I know you're working on a new book, because you've been telling me about it for at least 3 years, maybe 4 years, but we won't talk,
okay.
We won't count the years.
Well, I told you about it.
That it's called, let me say what it's called, at least I want to say it, Brother Malcolm's, okay, Visionary Strategic Pan-Africanism, Why It Enraged the United States Government. Now, tell
like
me about
you
it.
Say, if you heard me talk about it about 3 years ago, that's mainly what I was doing at that time. I didn't really start writing it until about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
I was kind of gathering materials and stuff like that here and there. But I actually started writing, but it's called Brother Malcolm X's Visionary Strategic Pan-Africanism. That's the column, you know, and why it enraged the United States government. And that book is focuses solely on what Brother Malcolm was doing internationally. That's all it focuses on. And the guy is to show the hostility and the alarm that they felt about him. In fact,
mm-hmm.
this British writer named Anthony Summers, he wrote a book back in the early 90s about J. Edgar Hoover. Official and confidential secret language of group. But he has one mention, that book is about almost 500 pages, has one mention of Brother Malcolm. And he says that one mention. He says that J. Edgar Hoover had a luncheon meeting with Senator Lyndon Johnson. Now, if he was Senator Lyndon Johnson, that means that it had to have happened before 1960, because Johnson became vice president in 1960. So he said in this book, this once, that he says that at a meeting with Senator Lyndon Johnson, J. Edgar Hoover said, quote, we wouldn't have any problem if we could get those two guys fighting, if we could get them to kill one another off. End of quote.
Okay.
Those two guys were Brother Malcolm and Dr. King.
Gotcha.
And of course, both of them ended up being assassinated. And that's what Hoover said that to Johnson, I assume sometime in the late 1950s. Because in Summers' book, it says, said it to Senator Lyndon Johnson, and Johnson became vice president in 1960. So he had to have said that before then. But that's what he said. We wouldn't have any problem if we get those two guys fighting, get them to kill one another off. And then after the assassination of Brother Malcolm, they had this organization called COINTELPRO, whose sole purpose was to find informants on the civil rights organizations, and in that they listed as one of their goals, we must prevent the rise of a black messiah. Malcolm X could have been one had he not been killed, and then they listed possible black messiahs. They listed Elijah Muhammad, Dr. King, and Stokely Carmichael. Then they said, no, forget about Elijah Muhammad because he's too old. And then they said Dr. King and Stokely Carmichael. And Dr. King ended up being assassinated, and Stokely ended up being exiled. This is in COINTELPRO.
Okay, so in our last 2 minutes, for years, we want to come, Port of Harlem readers know that we will let them know when your book is available, and we'll have you back when the book is out. But for our last 2 minutes or so, for years, many decades, you have had a booth at the National Black Memorabilia Collective and Fine Arts Show, just as Porter Harlem has. What is your connection in your heart between your many activities and black memorabilia?
It's all part of the incredible interest that I had. I had an interest in history when I was in elementary school. When I got to Howard, Dr. Lewis solidified that interest in history. And then, of course, with Brother Malcolm and his knowledge and a thing about the importance of history, that just got me there. So, of course, I automatically then became a collector. And I've been collecting ever since and participating in the shows. since the 1970s, I think.
And I know what you feel there. Can you show our audience what you feel there?
I used to have a tremendous collection of old ebonies, old jets. I was on the staff of Ebony Magazine. Yes, I was on the staff of Ebony Magazine from 1968 to 1976. Mm-hmm. I was on the staff of Ebony Magazine. And during that time, I wrote for Ebony and Jet. And then I've contributed articles to the New York Times and Essence and Black Enterprise and, a bunch of magazines. I've contributed articles to since then. I'm now a writer column for the Trice Edney Wire Services that goes out to about 30 or 40 black newspapers around the country. But I don't do that now on a regular basis. I do maybe one or two columns a month. When something really hits me, I don't just write a column. It's got to be something that really, kind of hits me.
Oh, okay. So the Black Media Show this year so far is going to be Saturday and Sunday, October 16th and 17th in Gaithersburg, Maryland, if all things go well. But before we end, Peter, again, when the book comes out, we'll let people know if you're going to have it available at the Black Mirror Video Show and if you're going to have book signings, et cetera.
Oh, yeah.
We all don't know.
Oh, yeah.
We all know what that's going to be like yet. But before we go on.
I forgot to share real quick about the book that I wrote, my memoir that I wrote in 2013. That's a memoir. Mm-hmm. About being involved with Brother, and fully about being involved with Brother Malcolm. It's a memoir, and that is still available now.
Okay. So, Peter, I want to thank you for sharing your historical tidbits with me throughout the decades and your stories with our readers over the decades. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Wayne, for doing one of the most important things in the world, which is solidifying and keeping history alive.
Okay. So, Peter, we're going to talk to you soon.
Okay.
And next time we're going to talk about our conversation at McDonald's. Which I keep secret for now. But it's a good one.
Okay.
It stays in my head.
Okay.
It stays in my head. All right, then.
Okay. Okay, man. Take care.
All right. Coming up next, our next guest is Augie Ogborn. To be more complete, I'll do him like I did Peter. His real name is David Augie Ogborn, and interesting, I really didn't know his first name until the past 2 weeks. That's interesting. Let me get him on in a second. Let's see if he's here. I know his number. Make sure I can get it. Let's see. We got David here.
Yeah.
David Augie.
But I gotta
we
hang
got
up.
You
I gotta hang up for you.
No, you're on now.
Okay. Okay, cool. Why are you putting me on after that dynamite dude, man? That brother was Malcolm X. Jesus Christ. You know, Augie's a homebound. I'm an old head now.
Well, let's talk about you. In 1975, Augie began serving as assistant to the historian to Chancellor James Williams, where he documented his work through photography and audio tape, and we might explain to some people what audio tape is, until 1987. And Williams is noted for his work on African civilizations prior to encounters with Europeans. His major work is The Destruction of Black Civilization, and was published in 1971 and 1974. So, Augie, you have a story that's worthy of telling. So, please tell me when you were telling me earlier that you read Williams' book, The Destruction of Black Civilization.
Yeah.
Then you went to Egypt. Then you met Williams. So how did you meet William, and how did that meeting evolve to your being his assistant for 12 whole years?
Well, what happened was, I went to Howard University, and you've been in school all my life. And what happened, a sister came from California who was telling me about vegetarian meals, and we were talking about vegetarian meals, and while she was cooking, when I looked in her bookcase, and it was this book, The Destruction of Black Civilization. And I had been in New York. Okay, turn off your phone. I had been in New York, and my father had in the bookcase was talking about Egypt and how great Egypt was and how, the things of the Egyptians. But I didn't have no idea that the Egyptians that they were talking about, the greatness, that they were black. They always, they never would tell us the truth. Our history really started, for me, was from slavery. And so when I hooked up with Chancellor's book, I really began to understand who I really was. And so what happened, like you said, I'd gone to Egypt. I'd read the book first, and then I'd gone to Egypt and had prepared myself for this trip. And I'm taking all these pictures and stuff of the pyramids and the Sphinx and getting a little history about them. And so when I get back home to New York, when I get back to Washington, you know, I hear a friend of mine, Clint Walker, interviewing Chancellor Williams on the radio on WHUR. So I call up Clint right away. He was sort of like a frat brother, and I'm asking him, like, how did you meet Chancellor Williams? Where is he? How did you know him? Because if you find a book that could influence your whole life and uplift you and give you all the strength that you need and the foundation that you need, that no man is greater than you, regardless. So I called and I said, how did you get to know Chancellor? He said, well, Chancellor doesn't live that far from you. He lives at the Woodner. And I lived on 16th Street, and the Woodner, I lived on 19th Street, and the Woodner was on 16th Street. So what I did was I wrote a letter to him. I wrote a letter that I went to Egypt. I read your book. I went to Egypt, and I have to meet you. It was also like a desperate letter. You know, I got to meet you kind of thing. And so what I did, you know, the Woodner was a kind of place that was half hotel and it was half apartments. It was the kind of place that if you was going to take a course for maybe 6 months, you could rent an apartment there. So when I run around there with this special delivery, I made a special delivery now. So I run around to the hotel, to the Woodner, and I go over to the desk and I say, "This is a special delivery for Chancellor Williams." So the guy tells me, "Well, take it up. You can take it up to him." I said, "Oh man, I ain't ready to meet that brother yet," but I did take it upstairs to the fifth floor. And it was a long hallway, down the hallway where his apartment was. And I stuck the letter through his little booth, through the little slot. And then I'm running away because I don't want to meet him yet. And before I could get down the other end of the hall, he opened the door and said, "Thank you." Now, I didn't hear from him the next day. I was upset. Wow, man, how come Chancellor ain't call me? Blah, blah, blah. I'm excited about this. So I did get a call from a guy named Kenny Palm, who was one of Chancellor's assistants at the time, called me up and said, "Chancellor will meet you next Wednesday between 3 and 5. And so now I had never met Chancellor before. I had no idea who he was or what anything about him. So when I go to his apartment, I knock on the door, he lets me in, and I didn't notice, but Chancellor was blind. He claimed that he was partially blind, but he had glaucoma, but he was really basically blind, period. And he told me when he sat down in his chair, he says, "Don't touch nothing in the back of this chair," which I never even knew what it was, back of the chair, but it was First Editions. In 1941, Chancellor wrote a bestseller called The Raven, and it was a biography of Edgar Allan Poe. And it was the best. And what happened was, in those days, when you send a transcript to a publisher, the publisher, you know, would send you back, "Well, we're going to publish your book. We need a picture of you to stick on the back cover." So Chancellor said, "Okay, I'll send you a picture of me." But Chancellor was slick. He sent a picture of Edgar Allan Poe. He said, "Edgar Allan Poe's picture should be on the book, on this book." And so, you know, that's what happened. So it was a bestseller in 1941. So now Chancellor's teaching at Howard. He taught at Howard like 27 years. And I didn't take any classes under him, even though I went there. But I had finished my history before I got to Howard anyway. So when I go to his apartment, man, I fasted that day because I wanted all the energy in my body and my mind to deal with this genius. And what happened was we got in there talking, you know, he talked an hour and I talked an hour. And, you know, I was a freelance photographer for the record companies. And so I was used to traveling and going places. So he asked me at this first time we met that would I be able to work a couple of hours with him a week? And I said, of course, you know. And then a couple of hours ended up taking him to the first trip we took was to Amherst, University of Mass Amherst. And, you know, see, Chancellor's book, The Destruction of Black Civilization, was so popular in academia that all the schools was really asking him and sending him letters to come and lecture about the book, because his book was one of the first, because he also hooked up with Yusef Ben Doc Hannon and John Henry Clark. My first trip with him, my second trip with him was to Chicago, was to the Third World Press, which was run by Haki Matabutu, Don L. Lee, and what happened when we got to the airport, O'Hare Airport in Chicago, there were two gentlemen sitting down that recognized Chancellor right away. And fortunately, I had my camera with me. So Chancellor sat down with these brothers, and it just so happened that one of them was Yusef Ben Jock Hannon, and the other one was John Henry Clark. And the picture of those three, even today, fascinates people that I got all three of them together. And there's even another picture
imagine.
With a guy named, pardon?
No, I can imagine, because there's pictures you let us use that I was just, I'm still amazed that you have them.
And then there was another another historian named John Jackson, who eventually I went to Chicago another time with Chancellor, and I got all four of them together, you know. And so, you know, what happened, Chancellor was the kind of guy, he was like a pain in the neck as a kid. His father was a freed slave, maybe. I don't know. He's from Bennettsville, South Carolina. But he's been up in Washington for a long time. So now his mother was, she was an evangelist. She was a cook and an evangelist. But I know she worked for a banker. And the same banker she worked for had a son that was the same age as Chancellor. Chancellor's five, and his son was five. And that's the first time Chancellor began to see the disparity in what the whites had and what the blacks had. He really got pissed off as a kid. Why do we have to get the old books from the white schools, and they get new books? I mean, he was going through that kind of thing. He also, he was a pain in the neck kind of kid, because while he was in high school is when he learned about Edgar Allan Poe, and what they were teaching him about Edgar Allan Poe, he wasn't going for. That's why he ended up writing his own biography of Edgar Allan Poe on his own. He ended up traveling through Richmond, where Edgar Allan Poe was, and he ended up being in Baltimore. Edgar Allan Poe spent a lot of time in Baltimore. But the main thing that Chancellor did was he wrote The Destruction of Black Civilization from the loser's point of view. Most history books was always written by the winners. And the winners, of course, would, you know, fluff it up and flake, you know, whatever, you know, they would come out with them being on top. So Chancellor wrote The Destruction really for anybody. He wanted the janitor to be able to know and understand what he was telling, and he also wanted the professors of them to understand what he was telling. Now, Chancellor, when he came to Howard, his mentor was Leo Hansberry. And Leo Hansberry at the time, even though he was teaching at Howard, he couldn't teach. He had to teach African history under the disguise of mythology. He couldn't even, you know, Howard was sort of an elitist kind of school in a way. You know, I don't know if they didn't want to be related to Africans or whatever, but I don't recall. But I know when you went to Howard, you had to pass the paper bag. Do you remember the paper bag test, you know?
No, that's so much at Howard,
you know.
Let me wrap that part up, and we might have to come back to that later, because now I want to just find out, how did all of that information from him and about him affect you personally? How did it affect your life?
Well, initially, you know, like I say, you know, I've been in school all my life and didn't know who I was. And it really kind of shocked me, because once I understood that Africans built the pyramids 2,500 years before Christ was born, which sort of blew my mind then. You know, you're not used to hearing, you know, 2,500 years before Christ was born? Wow. And, of course, in order to build pyramids, in other words, you had to have, you know, astrology and architecture and astronomy with the stars, and everything was sort of coordinated in a way. And, you know, and just think now, the pyramids are still up, you know, still around today, where, you know, I remember they were building some apartments in Arlington that fell down, you know. So when you think of the pyramids and the Sphinx. Now, one of the things about in Egypt, when the Arabs came over and they sort of mingled and mixed with the Africans, and it's sort of like in America, you know, the Indians were here.
But our last 5 minutes, you said it impacted you, because how it impacted you is because you didn't know much about yourself. And then how did that impact you? Knowing of yourself, how did that impact you?
Well, basically, I guess in a way, it impacted me in a way that I had confidence in myself, and that I felt that I could do anything. And I sort of took on the area. I got into photography, as you know. And being into photography, I got a chance to shoot, you know, Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu and Rosa Parks, and really, you know, I got interested in these people and sort of studied and read their books and stuff, and I got to know who I was. For a long time, I didn't know who I was. I was just playing around, having fun, you know, college and whatever, and flunked out and got back in, and, you know, but as a man, I became a real man, and when I got into Chancellor's book, I turned on everybody I knew that I grew up with. They would have some of my best friends' families would be arguing at the dinner table talking about Chancellor because I introduced him to him. And I introduced, you know, a lot. Well, we just didn't know our history. And not only we didn't know our history, fortunately for me, I became president of my family. And I tried to use some of Chancellor's values in family because, you know, Chancellor, in the destruction, he wrote an answer. He had answers in the book on how to survive and how to grow and how to have an organization that will survive. He sort of mentioned that, you know, you get a couple of people of like minds together and they discuss, you know, something and then they bring in other people of like minds and they can grow that way. And to me, personally, what happened to me reading and getting to know this brother and the history that I have, my history, my family's history stuff, no man is greater than me. No man.
Well, let me get this clear, though. You didn't know him. And you read the book first and went to Egypt first, then met him.
Right. Yeah, gotcha. You know, because, you know, it's not easy. You know, it's a heck of a thing when you read a book that affects your whole life,
mm-hmm.
which he did, because he even talked about, he talked about Nzinga, who was a queen of Angola. She was in Angola fighting the Angolan government, and she was efficiency in the military. Now, you know, we didn't know. You know what? This is the bottom line. Why do we have to see a movie about three mathematicians who got us to fly around the moon? How come it had to be a movie? How come that wasn't in the history books? Right now, by you saying that, how it affected me?
I guess you made it your point. Go ahead, but keep talking.
Okay. Well, how it affected me is that we have to redo the history books because we are part of history, and we don't need a month for our contributions that we've given to this country. And if people knew, majority of people knew the benefits of having black people and what they have done, you know, even when you talk about the real McCoy, and really, you know, and these mathematicians took us to the moon, even, you know. And all I got to say is Chancellor Williams is one of the greatest persons that I ever met. And because of him not being known as much as he should be, me and Kenny Palm and other brothers are really trying to do a documentary because Wesley Snipe did a documentary on John Henry Clark. And so we and some other brothers, we are on, you know, at the beginning stages of sort of like trying to put a documentary together on Chancellor Williams because of his greatness and what he has produced and given to this country and to the schools and education, whatever, you know, needs to be known. And
I hope eventually
that Augie will be able to present the world with more of Chancellor Williams.
Okay, in our last 2 minutes, as a photographer, you have had images of a writer publication from Essence to a must-say Port of Harlem. Have you ever started preserving your work for the next generation?
Yeah, well, believe it or not, man, I've already contacted Howard University because, you know, I went there and I informed them that I would like to leave part of my photo collection with them. And they contacted me right away, and, you know, said they were interested. So initially what happened, the librarian, they have built a new, at Howard University, they have built another section to the school's library. And they asked me, did I have any pictures and frames and matted that I could donate to the school for that particular section? And I said, yes, I would love to do that. And, you know, I really got my start in photography at Howard University, at the radio station. And they sort of funded me for my biggest exhibit that I had at one of their art centers. So other than that, man, you know, I just hope eventually that I have right now 8 chapters of Chancellor Williams on YouTube of the interview that I did with him in 1975, which dealt with black-on-black crime, drugs in a black neighborhood, women's liberation, and full employment. And, you know, it's just... And if anybody's interested, you could go on YouTube right now under Augie Ogburn and his 8 chapters broken up about Chancellor Williams from an interview that I did with him in 1975, which I converted to. It was cassettes in the beginning, then I converted it to a CD, and now it's digital. So I'm sending it out to family members and other people that are interested in Chancellor Williams, you know, what he was talking about.
Okay, well, thanks, Augie, for always being available to me for many years and always willing to provide Port of Harlem pictures and simply sharing your knowledge and your experiences.
Hey, man, I love it. You got to empty the cup to fill it up again.
Well, I thank you for emptying your cup inside our bowl.
Oh, man, thank you so much, Wayne, for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, we'll talk soon. And
okay,
our final
bye-bye,
guest,
my brother.
All right, take care. Our final guest is oral historian Dr. Janet Sims Woods. In 1993, Sims Woods interviewed several of the original 40 black women in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, or the first official women's branch of the armed services. It was created in 1942 when Franklin Roosevelt was president, and it later became the Women Army Corps, or the WACS. And the WACS was disbanded in 1978, a year I can very clearly remember, when Jimmy Carter was president and integrated with the male units. Let me see if I can get Janet on here, and then we could roll with the last section. So, Janet, do we have you? Janet, do we have you? That's interesting. We get to the end of the show, we have problems. Let's see. Maybe I hit the wrong button.
Okay. Wayne, I'm here.
Okay. Good. Go.
Okay. Yeah, I've been listening.
Well, I was wondering because today we had technical difficulties again, and I was like, okay, we'll get to the end of the show. Let's not have any more problems. Okay. So I gave the introduction to you already. I don't know if you heard it already, but I'm sure you
Yes,
you
I
talked.
Did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So I didn't say anything too wrong.
No.
Okay, so what motivated you to want to interview these pioneering women?
Well, you know, when you start a dissertation, you want to do a project that will provide new information. And not a lot had been written about the women that had gone into the Women's Army Corps during World War II. And I already knew two of them. I knew Debbie Roundtree, who was a minister at my church and a local lawyer in D.C. And also I knew Dr. Ed Howard. So I already had two women in mind to interview. And so from there, I just decided that I started contacting women. And so they said that they would do the interviews with me. And I interviewed, I only used four in my dissertation, four women, because although I interviewed several, I used only four because I wanted them to do their whole life history. And also it was coming up on the 50th anniversary of World War II. And they had also, once they came out of the military, I wanted to know what they did as far as working and things of that nature after they served in the military.
Okay. And so how did you narrow it down to those four, though? I know two of you said you knew already. So how did you narrow it down to those four?
Well, I started getting in touch with Charity Adams, who was the commander. And, of course, at that time, she had just gotten out of the hospital, so she was kind of reluctant. And so she said no. And but what I did, we had an ASALA conference out in her area, and so I went to visit her in Dayton. And I took the photographs, the World War II photographs that I had of the women. And so I went to her house, and we sit down and talked. I think once she realized I was serious about doing a dissertation and writing about them, she said she would participate. And the
let's
other
step back.
Was
go ahead.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm going to step back a second. Explain to people what ASALA is, please.
ASALA is the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, and that
right.
is where I met my
by,
other.
And it all started by Dr. Carter G. Woodson.
Yes.
And you're one of those people who keeping it alive.
We're trying, and we're
okay,
trying hard,
ahead.
And it's an organization that I do love. Okay, I and the fourth person I used was Dr. Clementine Skinner, and I had met her at the ASALA, which we sometimes call ASALA, sometimes we call it the Association. Us older folk call it the Association. Well, I had known Clementine Skinner for many, many, many years. We were on the executive council together, and the reason I found out she was in the military was our conference was in Dayton, and I had Charity Adams to come to a luncheon. And we're sitting there talking, and up walks Clementine Skinner, and she hollers out, "There's my commander." I said, "Dr. Skinner, you were in World War II?" She said, "Yes, I was in the WAC band." So that was my fourth person. So I got a chance to interview all of them. Yes.
Okay, after spending with such personal time with them, how did meeting and talking with them affect your life and your career?
Well, one of the things that I liked about, you know, like I say, it was 50 years after the war. And one of the things I really liked about it was their fortitude, their work ethic. They were the type of ladies that, you know, they said they never gave up. Debbie Roundtree, you know, 50 years later, she was still, and long after that, was still working as a lawyer. Martha Putney was writing and researching, and Clementine Skinner was very active with Astala and her group in Chicago. So they were just still very, very active women, and that impacted me because I always felt that, you know, if they, as older women, were still working, still doing things, you know, I didn't have a right to try to give up on things. You know how you get discouraged sometimes and, well,
exactly.
I don't think I'll do this anymore. But you know, when you think back on their lives and what they did and in a time of segregation, you know, you can't help but keep working. So they impacted me by just being the shoulders that I say I stand on.
Okay. So members of the original 40 African-American women were recruited by Dr. Mary Bethune, but that, I think, in itself is monumental, were also part of the first WAC officer training class. One of the 40 members, and you mentioned, was Dovie Johnson Roundtree, who went on to become a celebrated civil rights and criminal defense lawyer and minister in her 104 years. Can you talk a little bit more about her?
Oh, Debbie was just outstanding. She was a minister at Allen Chapel AME Church, where I was a member at one time. And of course, she was working here in D.C. as a lawyer. And she just had an outstanding career. She was very outspoken. And one of the things that she would often tell me is that because she had this preacher voice, that a lot of the lawyers would say that they didn't like to go up against her because she used her preacher voice in court, not mentioning the fact that she was very knowledgeable and did her work so that, you know, not only did she use her preacher voice, but she knew how to get her cases won.
And one of those cases was a landmark case, wasn't it, with the ICC or something of that nature?
Yeah, there was a transportation one that she won, and one of the big ones in D.C. was a murder. This gentleman, the lady that was a mistress to JFK and was killed, and a black man, a very illiterate black man, was charged with his murder. And, of course, she was able to get him off.
Wow.
Because he did not commit the murder, yes. But, I mean, she was just outstanding.
And, you know, and while I was researching for this episode, what I found so amazing about her, too, is that she did go to Allen AME Church, which is right in Southeast, not too far from my headquarters, and yet I knew nothing about her at all. Nothing.
And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write about these people, because a lot of times you just, they're not in the history books. So it's up on us to make sure that this history gets out there and the correct history of these ladies get out there. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to do some research on them and so that, you know, that story would be told. And the good thing about it was that because I'm an oral historian, I can tell your story. But the good thing is that I was able to get them to tell their own story, which is very important. Very important. And for several years, for about 3 years, right before World War anniversary of World War II, Martha Putney, the theme for Asala for about 3 years was on World War II. And Martha
mm-hmm.
Putney would go, she's also a member, would go to the conferences every year. And she would come to the conference every year and talk to a group. And I would just stand over there by the wall so I could watch the audience with their mouths open as she talked about her experiences, because they had never heard of it. A lot of them had heard of the, you know, Tuskegee Airmen, but most of them didn't know about the women. So
exactly.
That was one of the reasons I would have wanted it to tell their story.
Yeah, and I feel the same way. You know, I feel the same way about W. Johnson, the Roundtree in particular, because she walked the earth so close to where I walk now. And talking to you beforehand, you told me there's a building named after her on Alabama Avenue, Southeast, near the Allen AME Church. And I never saw her name on the building, but next time I go by the building, I will look at her name. But, you know, just looking at the name doesn't tell me who she is. That's the problem.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's why we have to keep telling their stories. We have to keep I do a lot of posting of Black history on my Facebook page. That's why I do that. I want to share the stories of what we have done as African American people.
And one of the things I was most surprised to hear that really showed in my mind how things have changed is that we talked earlier, you mentioned that during their time, that's when the WACs was actually formed and women were actually officially accepted into some portion of the armed service, that people thought that women who joined the armed services were either whores or lesbians. And I thought that was just unbelievable. But then I'm of another generation. But can you talk more about that?
It was, yes, when they told me that, and, you know, it hurt. You know, it hurt. But that was the attitude of many, many people. And, of course, they proved them wrong. They were there to do their job. And that's what they did. But, of course, that was the attitude of a lot of people that, like, I, for instance, I gave a presentation at an agency one time, and there was a lady in the audience. And when we finished, she started talking about the fact that her father, who was in the military, did not want her to go in because of that stigma. And so they didn't speak for many years and da-da-da-da-da. And so after, you know, he was getting ready, as he was transitioning, he finally told her how proud he was of her. And she just started crying. And the people at her office said, well, we have never heard that story before. And I said, well, she felt she was in a safe place. But, yeah, there was a stigma about these women going into the military. And, of course, they had to prove them wrong.
Yeah, I was listening to one of Ms. Roundtree's oral presentations on the net, and in specific, she spoke of being of people thinking they were whores, and I laughed because I hadn't talked to you yet, and I just like, what? And then when she kept talking about it, she said, well, in the first place, she had a hard time digesting what that meant, because there wasn't enough women to go around to all those men in the first place.
That's what she said. That's what she said. And one thing about what I liked about as I interviewed them later in life, they could laugh about some of the things that happened to them, like you know, being segregated, having segregated housing, and eating in the they could only eat at a certain table as designated for them to eat in the dining halls and things of that nature. So they could look back and kind of laugh at some things that happened to them as they were going through the military and, of course, later on in life as well.
But sadly, you know, I did imagine while she was saying that they could have tried to make 40 women or 40 women plus go around to all the men. I could have seen that happen.
Well, no, that didn't happen. And of course, now I'm going to tell you, now 40 women did not graduate. Only 36 of those first 40 graduated. And they were going to be, again, the officers that would, so they went off to candidate school. So they were going to be the officers that were going to train the other women as they came in. So women were coming in, coming in after this first class graduated. So they were doing the training for these women. So lots of women came in, but again, it wasn't, you know, that stigma was something that you had to fight against.
Right. So anything else about these women you wanted to share, especially considering today that we're still arguing about who should be in the Army and who should be included? You know, we moved past the don't ask, don't tell formula, and now we're into this whole thing of whether or not trans people should be included. Do you see a string between this whole issue of expanding the military or even expanding civilian life? Or I should say expanding the inclusion of civilian life or expanding the inclusion in military life to everybody.
I think there's always probably going to be some kind of argument going about not having this type of person in or that type of person coming in. Most of the people that are going in to serve their country. They're going in to do a job. And I think that's the main thing that we need to focus on is the fact that if we need people in the military to do their to do certain jobs, and that should be what the criteria for you getting in there is to, if you qualify, then, you know, you go in and you do your job.
Gotcha. Yeah, this was, and any other story that you could tell about any other women that you want to tell about any other women. But first of all, let me tell the people that are listening that if they want to ask you a question, they can press 1, and we can try to see if they can ask a question.
Okay.
Hello?
Clementine Skinner was a good friend, and she...
we have a question for you,
Hi, Janet. I'd like to know from either of you if there is a historical marker near that Roundtree building in D.C.
Not that I know of. I went to the when they opened it up. I have not been back there in several years, so not that I know of. It may be, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I haven't noticed one at all. In fact, I didn't know her name was on the building until Jan told me, so. And that's one of the issues I was telling Jan I had, that it's nice that her name is on the building, but if I don't know who she is, it's just like, okay, it's the name of the building. Who is it?
Right.
Thanks.
Any other callers? Yeah, thank you. Thanks for calling in. Any other callers? Okay, Jan, so you want to tell us another story? Or any other person you want to tell a story of?
Well, as I say, I was a friend for a long time with Clement. Found out that now when she went in, now the first women that went in, those that first group of 40 and the 36 that graduated, it had to be college graduates. But when she went in, she was not a college graduate. And all of the women that I, the four that I used in my dissertation, all used the GI Bill. And, of course, since Debbie was a college grad. All three of them were college grads, except for Clementine. And she told me, she used the GI Bill to take some kind of a sewing class. But she was so enthralled with education. Once she started going to school, that woman ended up with a PhD.
Wow.
And she was, she and the Asala branch in Chicago was really very active, and she was a wonderful member of that group who kept that organization going.
Okay. So we got one more minute left, but I did want to thank you for your historical tidbits and also for being a very good, loyal Port of Harlem reader and introducing our nonprofit, the Port of Harlem Gambian Education Partnership, to one of our most consistent donors and provider of library services information, technical information, Dr. Irene Owen. And to me, that was such an unselfish act.
Well, that's what we do. We connect people together. So, because it takes all of us working to get this information out and to get things done. And I thank you for the sharing of your history and all that you do, going to Africa and doing what you do there. It takes all of us.
Yeah, and
so
I think
we need to work together.
I think the ladies before you in the WAC proved that, and you've documented their stories, and you're proving it every day. So we appreciate that, and people oftentimes say that black people don't work together, and I don't know what black people they're speaking of, because in this case, black people are working together.
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay, what was interesting, too, when we were preparing these stories, I noticed that all three of you all are in the series called History Makers, and I think you're affiliated with Howard University, too. Is that correct?
Yes, I was at Moreland Spingarn Research Center for 31 years.
Okay, so that cop that you know that if anybody listened to all three interviews, that was the last part about them all being Howard people or being related to Howard. That was just coincidence.
It was. I had to laugh when I heard when he was saying that. I said, "Yes, indeed."
All right, well, everybody, thanks for listening to Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Go to portofharlem.net, and you can sign up for a free subscription. And please like us on Facebook. Thank you. Port of Harlem Talk Radio, portofharlem.net. All right. Thanks, Jan. Good night.
Okay. Good night.
All right.